Chapter 49. "You must be out of your mind, demanding to see the President this time of night," Earl Willover said angrily. Sandecker looked at the President's chief of staff, who was neatly attired in a dark double-breasted wool pinstripe that showed only the slightest sign of creases in the pants. Sandecker wondered if the man ever left his office and slept standing up. "Take my word for it, Earl, I wouldn't be here if it wasn't urgent. I won't wake the President unless faced with an international crisis that endangers the security of the nation." So far, Sandecker had held his temper in check, but it began to slip away. "All right, tell him there's a tax-paying voter downstairs in the White House office who's mad as hell."
"You are mad."
"Mad enough to charge up to his bedroom and wake him myself." Willover looked like he was on the verge of a boiling fit. "You try it, and I'll have the Secret Service take you in custody. A lot of innocent people, including women and children, are going to die if the President doesn't act." "I hear that old story every day of the week," Willover sneered. "And make jokes about the victims, right?" Willover finally lost it. "You've got an answer for everything, you arrogant anchor-clanker. I can break you any time I want to, you understand?" Sandecker moved close enough to Willover to smell the man's minty breath. "Listen up, Earl. One day the President's term of office will be over, and you'll only be another one of the great unwashed public again. Then I will ring your doorbell and tear out your liver."
"I bet you would, too," came a familiar voice.
Sandecker and Willover both turned and faced the President, who was standing in a doorway in his pajamas and bathrobe. He was nibbling from a plate of canapes he held in one hand. "I sneaked down for a late snack from the kitchen refrigerator and overheard heated voices." He stared at Sandecker. "Now suppose you tell me what this is all about, Admiral." Willover stepped in front of Sandecker. "Please, sir, it's a matter of little consequence." "Why don't you let me be the judge of that, Earl?" "Okay, Admiral, speak your piece." "First, let me ask you, Mr. President, have you been briefed on the latest developments on the Fort Fourreau operation?" The President looked at Willover. "I was told that your men, Pitt and Giordino, had managed to escape into Algeria, and that they provided vital information regarding Yves Massard's corrupt and unscrupulous hazardous waste operations. May I ask what your response is?"
"We are calling for an international environmental tribunal of European and North African legal representatives to meet and discuss a plan of action," answered Willover.
"Then you don't plan to, I believe you said, Mr. President, go in and take the place out ourselves?"
"Cooler heads have prevailed," said the President, nodding at Willover.
"Even now, with proof that chemicals leaking from Fort Fourreau are causing the expanding red tide, all anyone is going to do is sit down and talk about it," Sandecker said, controlling his exasperation.
"We'll discuss this another time," said the President, turning to return to his bedroom upstairs in the White House.
"Earl will set up an appointment." "Did Earl also brief you on the Tabeza gold mines?" asked Sandecker suddenly. The President hesitated and shook his head.
"No, I'm not familiar with the name."
"After Pitt and Giordino were captured at Fort Fourreau," Sandecker went on, "they were taken to another one of General Kazim and Yves Massard's sinister enterprises, a little-known gold mine where opposition and dissident prisoners are enslaved and worked to death under the most barbaric and inhumane conditions. A number of them were French engineers and their families Massard imprisoned so they couldn't return home and expose Fort Fourreau. My men also found the missing World Health Team that was supposedly killed in a plane crash, all horribly starved and exhausted from overwork and little food." The President gave Willover a cold stare. "It seems I'm kept in the dark on a number of matters."
"I try to do my job fielding priorities," Willover offered hastily.
"So where is this leading?" the President asked Sandecker.
"Knowing it was useless to ask you for a special force," Sandecker continued, "Hala Kamil again came to the rescue and volunteered the United Nations Critical Response Team. With Pitt and Giordino to guide them, Colonel Levant and his force landed in the desert near the mines, conducted a successful raid, and rescued 25 foreign national men, women, and children."
"Children were forced to work the mines?" the President interrupted. Sandecker nodded. "They belonged to the French engineers and their wives. There was also an American, Dr. Eva Rojas, who was a member of the World Health Team."
"If the raid was successful, what is the urgent problem?" demanded Willover.
Their transport, the aircraft they flew from Algeria, was destroyed on the ground at the Tabeza airstrip by fighters of the Malian Air Force. The entire force, along with the rescued captives, are trapped in the middle of Mali. It's only a matter of hours before Kazim's military finds and attacks them.
You paint a bleak picture, said the president seriously. Is there no way they can safely reach the Algerian border?
It would matter little if they did, explained Sandecker. Kazim won't hesitate to run the risk of a confrontation with the Algerian government to stop the captives from exposing the atrocities at Tabeza and dangers of Fort Faroe. He'll send his military deep into Algeria to destroy them and guarantee their silence.
The president went silent, studying the canapes without biting into one. The implications of what Sandecker had told him were not to be brushed aside, as he knew Willover was about to advise. But he could not stand by and do nothing while a backwater despot murdered innocent foreign citizens.
Kazim is as bad as Saddam Hussein, muttered the president. He turned to Willover.
I'm not going to hide under the covers on this one, Earl. Too many lives are at stake, including those of three Americans. We've got to lend a hand.
But, Mr. President, Willover protested.
Contact General Halverson at Special Forces Command in Tampa. Alert him for an immediate operation.
The president stared at Sandecker.
Who do you suggest to coordinate this thing, Admiral?
General Bach, commander of the UN Critical Response and Tactical Team. He's in contact with Colonel Avant and can provide General Halverson with constant updates on the situation.
The president set the canapes aside on a credenza and placed his hands on Willover's shoulders.
I value your advice, Earl, but I've got to act on this one. We can kill two birds with one stone and take half the flak if the operation goes sour. I want our special forces to secretly infiltrate Mali, rescue the UN tactical team and the captives. Then get the hell out before Kazim and Massoud know what hit them. Afterward, perhaps we can figure a way to neutralize the Fort Faroe waste project.
You get my endorsement, Sandecker smiled broadly.
I guess nothing I can say will change your mind, Willover said to the president.
No, Earl, said the president, retrieving his canapé tray. We're going to close our eyes and bet the bankroll on an inside straight.
And if we lose?
We can't lose.
Willover looked at him curiously.
Why not, sir?
The president matched Sendecker's smile.
Because I'm dealing the hand, and I have the greatest confidence in our special operations forces to kick slime like Kazim and Massoud into the bog where they belong.
Several miles west of Washington, D.C., in the Maryland countryside, a large hill rises above the flat surrounding farmland. Passing motorists who take the time to notice the anomaly think of it as merely a geological trick of nature. Almost none know that it was secretly man-made from soil that was excavated for a command center and shelter for the capital city's politicians and military leaders in World War II. During the Cold War, work never stopped, and the subterranean spread was enlarged into a vast storeroom for the nation's records and artifacts, dating back to the first pioneers who settled the eastern coastline in the 1600s. The interior space is so expansive it is not measured in meters or acres, but in square miles or kilometers. To those few who are aware of its existence, it is known as ASD, Archival Safekeeping Depository. Thousands of secrets are buried away in the seemingly unending archival storage bins of the depository. For some strange reason, known only to certain very few bureaucrats, entire sections of the depository hold classified material and objects that will never be revealed to the public. The bones of Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan, and Japanese records of their execution on Saipan, the secret conspiracy files of both Kennedy assassinations, the intelligence of Soviet sabotage behind American space rocket and shuttle accidents, and the retaliation at Chernobyl, staged films of the Apollo moon landing hoax, and much, much more. It was all filed and stored away, never to see the light of day. Since St. Julian Perlmutter didn't drive, he took a cab to the small Maryland town of Forestville. After waiting on a bus stop bench for nearly half an hour, he was finally picked up by a Dodge van.
Mr. Perlmutter, asked the driver, a government security agent wearing regulation-mirrored sunglasses.
I am him.
Please get in. Perlmutter did as he was told, thinking to himself that all this subterfuge was a childish game.
Don't you want to see my driver's license? He said acidly.
The driver, a dark brown-skinned African-American, shook his head. No need, you're the only one in this town who fits the description.
Do you have a name?
Ernie Nelson.
What agency you with? National Security, Federal Bureau, Special Secrets?
I'm not at liberty to say, answered Nelson officially.
Aren't you going to blindfold me?
Nelson gave a quick shake of his head. No need. Since your request to search through historical files was approved by the President, and you once held a Beta Q clearance, I think you can be trusted not to reveal what you see today.
If you had dug deeper into my file, you'd have seen that this is my fourth research trip to ASD.
The agent did not respond and remained silent for the rest of the trip. He turned off the main highway and drove down a paved road to a security gate, showed his credentials, and entered. They passed through two more guard stations before the road led into a small barn-like structure in the middle of a farm, complete with pigs and chickens and wash hanging on a line. Once inside the barn, they rolled down a wide concrete ramp that dropped deep underground. They finally arrived at a security station where the agent parked the car. Perlmutter knew the routine. He exited the car and walked over to a waiting electric vehicle that looked similar to a golf cart. An archivist curator wearing a white lab coat shook Perlmutter's hand.
Frank Moore, he introduced himself. Good to see you again.
A pleasure, Frank. How long has it been?
3 years since you were last here. You were doing research on the Sakito Maru,
the Japanese passenger cargo ship that was sunk by the U.S. submarine Trout. As I recall, she was carrying German V-2 rockets to Japan.
You have a good memory.
I refreshed it while digging out the records of your previous visits, Moore admitted.
What can I do for you this trip?
Civil War, answered Perlmutter. I'd like to study any records that might throw some light on the mysterious loss of a Confederate ironclad.
Sounds interesting.
Moore motioned to a seat in the electric car. Our Civil War records and artifacts are housed in buildings about 2 kilometers from here. After a final security check and a brief meeting with the curator in charge, Perlmutter signed an affidavit stating that he would not publish or make public any of his findings without government approval. Then he and Moore moved off in the electric auto, passing a small crew of men who were unloading mementos and keepsakes people had left at the Vietnam Veterans Memorial. Photographs, old army boots and uniforms, buttons, watches and wedding rings, dog tags, dolls. Each object was catalogued, tagged, and placed in plastic wrappers on endless shelves. The government threw nothing away. Though he had seen part of the subterranean expanse on his previous visits, Perlmutter could not help but be astounded by the incredible size of the place and the tier upon tier of storage bins full of records and old artifacts, a great many of them from foreign countries. The Nazi section alone covered the size of 4 football fields. The Civil War memorabilia was housed in 4 3-story buildings. The concrete ceilings of the depository were 15 meters high. Placed in neat rows in front of the structures, different types of cannon from the Civil War stood as pristine and immaculate as when they were sent to fields of battle. They were mounted on their carriages and hitched to limbers that still held shot and shell. Immense naval cannon from such famous ships as the Hartford, the Kearsarge, the Carondelet, and the Merrimack were also on display as if for inspection. The records are kept in Building A, explained Moore. Buildings B, C, and D hold weapons, uniforms, medical relics, and furniture once belonging to Lincoln, Jefferson Davis, Lee, Grant, and other famous people from the war between the states. They stepped from the vehicle and entered Building A. The ground floor was one vast sea of filing cabinets.
Any papers pertaining to the Confederacy are on the ground floor, Moore said, sweeping his hands around the cavernous room.
All Union records are filed on the 2nd and 3rd.
Where would you like to begin?
Anything you have on the Texas.
Moore paused to thumb through several pages of a directory he had carried in from the vehicle. Confederate naval records are kept in the blue files along the far wall.
Despite the fact that no one had been through the files in years, and in many cases never since storage, there was surprisingly little dust. Moore helped Perlmutter zero in on a packet containing the known history on the ill-fated ironclad. Moore pointed to a table and chair. "Make yourself comfortable. You're familiar with the regulations regarding the care of records and know that I'm required to remain close by to monitor your research."
"I'm fully aware of the rules," Perlmutter acknowledged.
Moore held up his watch. "Your permit to conduct research at ASD ends after 8 hours. Then we must return to the curator's office where you will be driven back to Forestville. Do you understand?" Perlmutter nodded.
"Then I had best get started."
"Go ahead," said Moore, "and good luck."
Within the first hour, he had cleaned out 2 gray metal file cabinets before he found an ancient yellow file folder containing records of the Confederate steamship Texas. The papers inside revealed little historic information that wasn't already known and published. Specifications of the warship's construction, eyewitness reports of her appearance, one sketch by her chief engineer, and a list of her officers and crew. There were also several contemporary accounts of her running battle with Union warships during her historic dash into open seas. One of the articles, written by a northern reporter on board a Union monitor that took hits from the Texas, had 2 lines cut out.
Why the censorship? Wondered Perlmutter, curiously.
It was the first time in all his years of researching on Civil War shipwrecks that he had come across a display of censors' scissors. Then he found a brittle news clipping and carefully unfolded it on the table. It was a deathbed statement given by a man named Clarence Beecher to a British reporter in a small hospital outside of York. Beecher claimed he was the only survivor of the mysterious disappearance of the CSS Texas. Beecher's dying words described the voyage across the Atlantic and up a large African river. The ship steamed comfortably past hundreds of miles of lush shorelines before entering the outskirts of a great desert. Because the pilot was unfamiliar with the uncharted river, he mistakenly turned off the main channel into a tributary. They steamed on another 2 days and nights before the captain realized the mistake. When coming about to return downriver, the ironclad grounded, and no amount of effort could set her free. The officers conferred and decided to wait out the summer until the fall rains raised the river again. There was a limited supply of food on board, but the river would provide the necessary water. The captain also bought goods from passing tribes of Tuaregs, paying with gold. On 2 occasions, large bands of desert bandits made the mistake of attempting to attack and loot the grounded warship of its seemingly inexhaustible gold supply. By August, typhoid, malaria, and a starvation diet had ravaged the crew, decimating their numbers until there were only 2 officers, the president, and 10 seamen who could still walk. Perlmutter stopped and gazed off into space. His curiosity snagged. Who was the president Beecher referred to? He found it most intriguing. Beecher went on to say that he and 4 other armed men were selected to row down the river in one of the ironclad's boats to try and find help from the outside world. Only Beecher barely survived to reach the mouth of the Niger River. Nursed back to health by merchants at a British trading outpost, he was given free passage to England, where he eventually married and became a farmer in Yorkshire. Beecher said he never returned to his native state of Georgia because he was certain to be hung for the terrible crime committed by the Texas, and he had been too frightened to speak about it until now. After he breathed his last, the doctor and Beecher's wife shrugged off his final statement as the demented ravings of a dying man. It appeared that the reporter's editor had only printed the story because of a slow news day and a lack of editorial to fill up that day's paper. Perlmutter reread the article a second time. He would have liked to accept it at face value, despite the skepticism of the wife and doctor. But a quick check of the crew showed there was no Clarence Beecher present during muster immediately before the Texas left the Navy Yard at Richmond, Virginia. He sighed and closed the file. "I have all I'm going to find here," he said to Moore. "Now I'd like to hunt through Union Navy records." Moore helpfully returned the files to their respective cabinets and guided him up a steel stairway to the second floor. "What month and year are you interested in?" he asked.
"April 1865.
They threaded their way through narrow aisles stacked to the roof with cabinets on top of cabinets. Moore produced a ladder in case Perlmutter wanted to probe files in the upper stratosphere and directed him to the proper cabinet. Methodically, Perlmutter began expanding his search from April 2, 1865, the date the Texas cast off from the pier below Richmond. He had his own system for research investigations, and there were few who were better at scratching out leads than him. He used dogged persistence along with instinctive reasoning to narrow down the deadwood from the consequential. He started with official reports of the battle. When he exhausted those, he went on to eyewitness accounts by civilians who watched along the banks of the James River and crewmen on the Union warships. Within 2 hours, he had scanned the pertinent contents of nearly 60 letters and 15 diaries. He transcribed notes on a large legal pad, all the while under the watchful gaze of Frank Moore, who trusted Perlmutter, but had caught too many certified researchers trying to steal historical papers and letters not to be conscientious. Once Perlmutter found the thread, he began to unravel it as one offhand description, one seemingly insignificant bit of information, led to revelation after revelation of a story that seemed too incredible to believe. Finally, when he could go no further, he motioned to Moore. "How much time do I have?" 2 hours and 10 minutes. "I'm ready to move on. Where do you wish to look?" "Any private correspondence or documents you might have of Edwin McMaster's Stanton." Moore nodded. "Lincoln's crusty old Secretary of War. I've no idea what we have on him. His papers have never been fully catalogued. But it would be upstairs on the U.S. government documents floor." The Stanton files were voluminous, 10 file cabinets full. Perlmutter worked steadily, stopping only once to go to the nearest bathroom. He waded through the documents as swiftly as he could, finding surprisingly little on Stanton's relationship with Lincoln near the end of the war. It was a well-known bit of history that the Secretary of War did not like his president, and had destroyed a number of pages from the diary of Lincoln's assassin, John Wilkes Booth, including a number of papers relating to Booth's co-conspirators. To the frustration of historians, Stanton had purposely left many unanswered questions swirling around the assassination at Ford's Theater. Then, with only 40 minutes left on his deadline, Perlmutter struck pay dirt. Hidden in the extreme back of a cabinet, Perlmutter found a packet, yellowed with age, that still had an unbroken wax seal on it. He stared at the brown inked writing that gave the date as July 9, 1865, 2 days after Booth's fellow conspirators, Mary Surratt, Louis Payne, David Herold, and George Atzerodt, were hanged in the Washington Arsenal's prison yard. Under the date were the words, "Not to be opened until 100 years after my death." It was signed Edwin M. Stanton. Perlmutter sat down at a study table, broke the seal, opened the packet, and began reading the papers inside with 27 years leeway on Stanton's instructions. As he read, he felt as if he was transported back in time. Despite the coolness of the underground facility, beads of sweat glistened on his forehead. When he finished 40 minutes later and set the final paper aside, his hands were trembling. He exhaled his breath in a long, silent sigh and shook his head very slowly. "My God," Perlmutter whispered. Moore looked across the table at him. "Find something interesting?" Perlmutter did not answer. He simply stared at the pile of old papers and muttered, "My God," over and over.